Maybe I ought to turn you loose on my broke airplane. Wait till I have both arms back. Jack pulled his arm out of the sling and moved it around as they went down to the library level. What's Kathy say about that? What docs always say. Hell, if you get well too soon, they lose money. He moved his wrist around. This thing knots up like he wouldn't believe. How's it feel? Pretty good. I think I might get full use back. At least I haven't had it quit on me yet. Jack checked his watch. Want to catch the news? Sure. Ryan flipped on the small TV on his deck. Cable had finally made it down his road, and he was already hooked on CNN. It was so nice to get the national and world news whenever you wanted. Jack dropped into his swivel chair while Robbie selected another in the corner. It was a few minutes short of the hourly headlines. Jack left the sound down. How's the book coming? Getting there. I have all the information in line, finally. 4 more chapters to write, and 2 I have to change around some, and it's done. What did you change? Turned out that I got bum data. You were right about that deck-spotting problem on the Japanese carriers. I didn't think that sounded right, Robbie replied. They were pretty good, but they weren't that good. I mean, we took them at Midway, didn't we? What about today? The Russians? Hey, Jack, anybody wants a fool with me and my Tomcat better have his will fixed up. They don't pay me to lose, son. Jackson grinned like a sleepy lion. Nice to see such confidence. There's better pilots than me, Robbie admitted. 3, as a matter of fact. Ask me again in a year when I'm back in the groove. Oh, yeah, Jack laughed. The laugh died when he saw the picture on the TV screen. That's him. I wonder why. He turned the sound up. Killed, including 5 police officers. An intensive land, sea, and air search is underway for the terrorists who snatched their convicted comrade while en route to a British prison on the Isle of Wight. Sean Miller was convicted only 3 weeks before in the daring attack on the Prince and Princess of Wales within sight of Buckingham Palace. 2 police officers and 1 of the terrorists were killed before the attack was broken up by American tourist Jack Ryan of Annapolis, Maryland. The picture changed to show the weather on the channel and a Royal Navy helicopter, evidently searching for something. It changed again to a file tape of Miller being taken out of the Old Bailey. Just before he was put in the police van, Miller turned to face the camera, and now, weeks later, his eyes stared again into those of John Patrick Ryan. Oh, my God, Jack muttered. Chapter 10 Plans and Threats. You shouldn't blame yourself, Jimmy, Murray said. And Bob's going to make it. That's something. Certainly, Owens replied sardonically. There's even a 50% chance that he'll learn to walk again. What of the others, Dan? 5 good men gone, and 4 civilians along with them. And maybe the terrorists, too, Murray pointed out. You don't believe that any more than I do. It had come as a piece of blind luck. A Royal Navy minehunter ship conducting an ongoing sonar survey of the English Channel had found a new object on the bottom and immediately sent a camera sled down to classify it. The videotape showed the remains of a 10-meter Zodiac-type inflatable boat with 200-horse outboard motors. It had clearly sunk as the result of an explosion near the gas tanks, but there was no evidence of the men who'd been aboard or their weapons. The vessel's skipper had immediately grasped the importance of the discovery and informed his superiors. A salvage crew was preparing now to go out and raise the wreck. It's a possibility. One of them might have screwed up. The boat blew. The bad guys get dumped in the drink. And the bodies? Fish food. Murray smirked. Makes a nice image, doesn't it? You are so fond of punting, Dan. Just what percentage of your salary would you wager on that hypothesis? Owens wasn't in the mood for humor. Murray could see that the head of C-13 still looked on this as a very personal defeat. Not very much, the FBI representative conceded. So you think a ship picked them up, It's the only thing that makes the least bit of sense. 9 merchant vessels were close enough to have been involved. We have the list. So did Murray. It had already been forwarded to Washington, where the FBI and CIA would both work on it. But why not recover the boat, too? Obvious, isn't it? What if one of our helicopters saw them doing it? Or it might have been too difficult for the weather conditions. Or they might just not have wished to trouble themselves. They do have ample financial resources, don't they? When will the Navy raise the wreck? If the weather holds, day after tomorrow, Owen said. That was the one thing to be happy about. Then they'd have physical evidence. Everything made in the world carried trademarks and serial numbers. Somewhere there would be records of sale. That was how many successful investigations had started. A single sales slip in a single shop had often led to the conviction of the most dangerous criminals. From the videotape, the outboards on the boat looked like American Mercury motors. The Bureau had already been alerted to run that lead down as soon as the engine numbers were in. Murray had already learned that Mercury motors were a favorite all over the world. It would make matters harder, but it was still something. And something was always better than nothing. The resources of the Metropolitan Police and the Bureau were designed for precisely such a task. "Any breaks on the leak?" Murray asked. This touched the rawest nerve of all. "He'd better pray we don't find him," Owen said quietly. There was as yet no danger that this would happen. There had been a total of 31 people who'd known the time and route for the prisoner transfer, and 5 of them were dead. Even the driver of the van hadn't known beforehand. That left 26, ranging from a few members of C-13, 2 more high officials in the Metropolitan Police, 10 in the Home Office, a few more in MI5, the Security Service, and various others. Every one of them had a top-drawer security clearance. Not that a clearance matters a damn, Owens told himself again. By definition, a leak had to come from some bastard with a top-drawer clearance. But this was different. This was treason. It was worse than treason. A concept that Owens hadn't even thought possible until the last week. Whoever had leaked this had also to have been involved in the attack on the royal family. To betray national security secrets to a foreign power was sufficiently heinous to make the commander think in unprofessional terms. But deliberately to endanger the royal family itself was so incomprehensible a crime that Owens had scarcely been able to believe it possible. This wasn't someone of dubious mental state. This was a person with intelligence and considerable skill at dissimulation, someone who had betrayed a trust both personal and national. There had been a time in his country when such people died by torture. It was not a fact that Owens was proud of, but now he understood why it had happened, how easily one might countenance such punishment. The royal family served so many functions for the United Kingdom, was so greatly loved by the people. And someone, probably someone very close to them, was quite willing to betray them to a small band of terrorists. Owens wanted that person. Wanted to see him dead. Wanted to watch him die. There could be no other punishment for this kind of crime. His professionalism returned after the few seconds of grim revelry. We won't find the bastard by wishing him dead. Finding him means police work. Careful, painstaking, thorough investigation. Owens knew how to do that. Neither he nor the elite team of men on the investigation would rest until they succeeded. But none of them doubted that they would ultimately succeed. That's 2 bricks you have, Jimmy, Murray said after reading his friend's mind. It wasn't hard to do. Both men had handled hard cases, and police differ little over the world. Indeed, Owen said, almost smiling. They ought not to have tipped their hand. They should have bent every effort to protect their source. We can compare the lists of who knew that His Highness was coming in that afternoon, and who knew that young Mr. Miller was going to Lymington. And the telephone operators who put the calls through, Murray reminded him. And the secretaries and co-workers who might have overheard, and the girlfriends or boyfriends who might have heard during some horizontal conversation. Thank you ever so much for that, Dan. One needs encouragement at a time like this. The Englishman walked over to Murray's cabinet and found a bottle of whiskey. A Christmas present, still unopened on New Year's Eve. You're right that they should have protected their intel source. I know you'll get him, Jimmy. I will put some money down on that. Owens poured the drinks. It was gratifying to see that the American had finally learned to drink his whiskey decently. In the past year, Owens had broken Murray of the need to put ice in everything. It was shameful to contaminate single malt Scotch whiskey. He frowned at another recurring thought. What does that tell us about Sean Miller? Murray stretched his arms out. More important than you thought, maybe. Maybe they were afraid you'd break information out of him. Maybe they just wanted to keep their perfect record. Maybe something else. Owens nodded. In addition to the close working relationship Scotland Yard had with the FBI, Owens valued the opinions of his colleague. Though both were experienced cops, Murray could always be trusted to have a slightly different slant on things. 2 years before, Owens had been surprised to learn how valuable this might be. Though he never had thought about it, Murray had used his colleague's brain the same way on several occasions. So what might that make, Miller? Owens wondered aloud. Who can say? Chief of operations? Murray waved his glass. Awfully young for that. Jimmy, the guy who dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima was a full colonel in the Air Force and 29 years old. Hell, how old is this O'Donnell character? That's what Bob Hyland thinks. Owens stared into his glass for a moment, frowning again. Bob's a smart kid, too. God, I hope you can put him back on the street. If not, we can still use him in the office, Commander Owens said positively. He does have a fine brain for the business of investigations. Too good to be lost now. Well, I must be off. New Year's Eve, Dan. What do we drink to? That's obvious. A successful investigation. You're going to get that source, Jimmy, and he's going to give you the information you need. Murray held his glass up. To a closed case. Yes. Both men emptied their glasses. Jimmy, do yourself a favor and give it a night off. Clear the old head out and start fresh in the morning. Owen smiled. I'll try. He picked up his overcoat and walked toward the door. One last thing. It hit me on the drive over. These chaps, the ULA, have broken all the rules, haven't they? That's true enough, Murray replied as he locked up his files. There's only one rule they haven't broken. Murray turned. Oh? What's that? They've never done anything in America. None of them do that. Murray dismissed the idea. None have had much of a reason before. So? Dan, the ULA might have a reason now, and they've never been reticent about breaking the rules. It's just a feeling, no more than that. Owens shrugged. Well, good night, and a happy new year to you, Special Agent Murray. They shook hands ceremonially. And to you, Commander Owens. Give my love to Emily. Dan saw him to the door, locked it, and returned to his office to make sure all his secure files were locked up properly. It was pitch dark outside at, he checked his watch, 5:45. Jimmy, why did you say that? Murray asked the darkness. He sat back down in his swivel chair. No Irish terrorist group had ever operated in the United States. Sure, they raised money there, in the Irish neighborhoods and saloons of Boston and New York, made the odd speech about their vision for the future of a free, united Ireland, never bothering to say that as committed Marxist-Leninists, their vision of Ireland was of another Cuba. They had always been shrewd enough to know that Irish Americans might not feel comfortable with that little detail. And there was the gun running. That was largely something in the past. The PIRA and the INLA currently got most of their weapons on the open world market. There were also reports that some of their people had gotten training in Soviet military camps. You couldn't tell a man's nationality from a satellite photograph, nor could you recognize a specific face. These reports had never been confirmed sufficiently to be released to the press. The same was true of the camps in Libya and Syria and Lebanon. Some people, fair-skinned people, were being trained there. But who? The intelligence got a little confused on this point. It was different with the European terrorists. The Arabs who got caught often sang like canaries, but the captured members of the PIRA and INLA and the Red Army faction and Action Directe of France and all the other shadowy groups gave up their information far more grudgingly. A cultural thing. Or maybe they could simply be more certain that their captors would not, could not, use interrogation measures still common in the Middle East. They'd all been raised under democratic rules and knew precisely the weaknesses of the societies they sought to topple. Murray thought of them as strengths, but recognized the inconveniences that they imposed on law enforcement professionals. The bottom line was still that PIRA and INLA had never committed a violent crime in America. Never. Not once. But Jimmy's right. The ULA has never hesitated to break a rule. The royal family was off limits to everyone else, but not the ULA. The PIRA and INLA never hesitated to advertise its operations. Every terrorist group advertises its operations. But not the ULA. He shook his head. There wasn't any evidence to suggest that they'd break this rule. It was simply the one thing that they hadn't done. Yet. Not the sort of thing to start an investigation with. But what are they up to? He said aloud. Nobody knew that. Even their name was an anomaly. Why did they call themselves the Ulster Liberation Army? The nationalist movement always focused on its Irishness. It was an Irish nationalist movement. But the ULA's very name was a regional expression. Ulster was invariably the prefix of the reactionary Protestant groups. Terrorists didn't have to make all that much sense in what they did, but they did have to make some sense. Everything about the ULA was an anomaly. They did the things no one else would do, called themselves something no one else would. They did the things no one else would. That's what was chewing on Jimmy, Murray knew. Why did they operate that way? There had to be a reason. For all the madness of their actions, terrorists were rational by their own standards. However twisted their reasoning appeared to an outsider, it did have its own internal logic. The PIRA and INLA had such logic. They had even announced their rationales, and their actions could be seen to fit with what they said. To make Northern Ireland ungovernable. If they succeeded, the British would finally have enough of it and leave. Their objective, therefore, was to sustain a low-level conflict indefinitely and wait for the other side to walk away. It did make conceptual sense. But the ULA has never said what it's up to. Why not? Why should their objective be a secret? Hell, why should the existence of a terrorist group be a secret? If they're running operations, how can it be a secret? Then why have they never even announced their existence, except within the PIRA-INLA community itself? This can't be completely unreasoned action, he reminded himself. They can't be acting completely without reason and still be as effective as they've been. Damn! The answer was there. Murray could feel it floating at the edge of his consciousness. But his mind couldn't quite reach that far. The agent left his office. Two Marines were already patrolling the corridors, checking that the doors were locked. Dan waved to them on the way to the elevator, his mind still trying to assemble the pieces into a unified picture. He wished that Owens hadn't left so soon. He wanted to talk this one over with Jimmy. Maybe the two of them could make sense of it all. No, he told himself, not maybe. They'd find it. It was there, waiting to be found. I bet Miller knew, Murray thought. What a dreadful place, Sean Miller said. The sunset was magnificent, almost like one at sea. The sky was clear of the usual urban pollution, and the distant dunes gave a crisp, if crenellated, line for the sun to slide behind. The odd thing was the temperature range, of course. The noon temperature had reached 92, and the locals thought of this as a cool day. But now, as the sun sank, a cool wind came up, and soon the temperature would drop to freezing. The sand couldn't hold the heat, and with the clear, dry air, it would just radiate away, back to the stars. Miller was tired. It had been that sort of day. Refresher training. He hadn't touched a weapon in nearly 2 months. His reactions were off, his marksmanship abysmal, his physical condition little better. He'd actually gained a few pounds on prison food, something that had come as quite a surprise. In a week, he'd have that run off. The desert was good for that. Like most men born in the higher latitudes, Miller had trouble tolerating this sort of climate. His physical activity made him thirsty, but he found it difficult to eat when it was so hot. So he drank water and allowed his body to turn in on itself. He'd lose the weight and harden his body more quickly here than anywhere else. But that didn't make him like the place. 4 more of their men were here also, but the remainder of the rescue force had immediately flown home via Rome and Brussels, putting a new string of entry stamps on their travel passports. "It's not Ireland," O'Donnell agreed. His nose crinkled at the smell of dust and his own sweat. Not like home. No smell of the mist over the peat, or coke fires on the hearths, or the alcoholic ambience of the local pub. That was an annoying development. No liquor. The locals had got another attack of Allah and decided that even the fellow members of the International Revolutionary Community could not break God's law. What a bloody nuisance. It wasn't much of a camp. 6 buildings, one of them a garage, an unused helicopter pad, a road half covered with sand from the last storm, 1 deep well for water, a firing range, nothing else. In the past, as many as 50 people had cycled through here at a time. Not now. This was the ULA's own camp, well separated from camps used by other groups. Every one of them had learned the importance of security. On a blackboard in hut number 1 was a schedule provided by other fair-skinned friends that gave the Passover times for American reconnaissance satellites. Everyone knew when to be out of sight, and the camp's vehicles were under cover. 2 headlights appeared on the horizon, heading south toward the camp. O'Donnell noted their appearance, but said nothing about it. The horizon was far away. He put his arms into the sleeves of his jacket to ward off the gathering chill as he watched the lights slide left and right, their conical beams tracing over the dunes. The driver was taking his time, Kevin saw. The lights weren't bouncing about. The climate made it hard for a man to push himself hard. Things would get done tomorrow, God willing. Inshallah, a Latin colleague had once told him, meant the same thing as mañana, but without the urgency. The vehicle was a Toyota Land Cruiser, the 4-wheel drive that had replaced the Land Rover in most places. The driver took it right into the garage before getting out. O'Donnell checked his watch. The next satellite pass was in 30 minutes. Close enough. He rose and walked into hut number 3. Miller followed, waving to the man who'd just come into the camp. A uniformed soldier from the camp's permanent force closed the garage door and otherwise ignored them. "Glad to see you got out, Sean," the visitor said. He carried a small satchel. "Thank you, Seamus." O'Donnell held open the door. He was not one to stand on ceremony. "Thank you, Kevin." "You're just in time for dinner," the chief of the ULA said. "Well, one can't always be lucky," Seamus Padraig Connolly said. He looked around the inside of the hut. "No wogs about?" "Not in here," O'Donnell assured him. "Good." Connolly opened his satchel and brought out 2 bottles. "I thought you might like a drop of the pure." "How did you get it past the bastards?" Miller asked. "I heard about the new rule. I told them I was bringing in a gun, of course." Everyone laughed as Miller fetched 3 glasses and ice. "You always used ice in this place." When are you supposed to arrive at the camp? O'Donnell referred to the one 40 miles away used by the PIRA. I'm having some car trouble and staying the night with our uniformed friends. The bad news is that they've confiscated my whiskey. Bloody heathens. Miller laughed. The three men toasted one another. How was it inside, Sean? Connolly asked. The first round of drinks was already gone. Could have been worse. A week before Kevin came for me, I had a bad time with some thugs. The peelers put them up to it, of course, and they had a merry time. Bloody faggots. Aside from that, it is so entertaining to sit there and watch them talk and talk and talk like a bunch of old women. You didn't think that Sean would talk, did you? O'Donnell asked reprovingly. The smile covered his feelings. Of course, they had all worried about that. They had worried most of all what might happen when the PIRA and INLA lads in Parkhurst Prison got hold of him. Good lad. Connolly refilled the glasses. So, what's the news from Belfast? The chief asked. Johnny Doyle is not very pleased with having lost Maureen. The men are becoming restless. Not much, mind, but there is talk. Your op in London, Sean, in case you've not been told, had glasses filled and raised throughout the six counties. That most citizens in Northern Ireland, Protestant and Catholic, had been disgusted by the operation mattered not to Connolly. His small community of revolutionaries was the entire world. One does not get drunk for a failure, Miller observed sourly. That bastard Ryan. But it was a splendid attempt. It is clear enough that you were unlucky, no more than that, and we are all slaves to fortune. O'Donnell frowned. His guest was too poetic for Kevin's way of thinking, despite the fact, as Connolly was fond of pointing out, that Mao himself had written poetry. Will they try to spring, Maureen? Connolly laughed at that one. After what you did with Sean here, not bloody likely. However did you pull that off, Kevin? There are ways. O'Donnell let it go at that. His intelligence source was under strict orders not to do a thing for 2 months. Dennis's bookstore was closed so far as he was concerned. The decision to use him to get information for the rescue operation hadn't come easy. That was the problem with good intelligence, his teachers had hammered into his head years before. The really valuable stuff was always a risk to the source itself. It was a paradox. The most useful material was often too dangerous to use, but at the same time, intelligence information that could not be used had no value at all. Well, you've gotten everyone's attention. The reason I'm here is to brief our lads on your operation. Really? Kevin laughed. And what does Mr. Doyle think of us? The visitor crooked a comically accusing finger. You are a counter-revolutionary influence whose objective is to wreck the movement. The op on the Mall has had serious repercussions on the other side of the Atlantic. They'll be sending some of their chaps to Boston in another month or so to set things right, to tell the Yanks that they had nothing to do with it, Connolly said. Money. We don't need their bloody money, Miller objected, and they can put their moral support up. Mustn't offend the Americans, Connolly pointed out. O'Donnell raised his glass for a toast. The devil with the bloody Americans. As he drank off the last of his second whiskey, Miller's eyes snapped open sharply enough to make a click. Kevin, we won't be doing much in the UK for a while. Nor in the six counties, O'Donnell said thoughtfully. This is a time to lie low, I think. We'll concentrate on our training for the moment, and await our next opportunity. Seamus, how effective might Doyle's men be in Boston? Connolly shrugged his shoulders. Get enough liquor into them, and they'll believe anything they're told, and toss their dollars into the hat as always. Miller smiled for a moment. He refilled his own glass this time as the other two talked on. His own mind began assembling a plan. Murray had had a number of assignments in the Bureau over his many years of service, ranging from junior agent involved in chasing down bank robbers to instructor in investigation procedures at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia. One thing he'd always told the youngsters in the classroom was the importance of intuition. Law enforcement was still as much art as science. The Bureau had immense scientific resources to process evidence, had written procedures for everything, but when you got down to it, there was never a substitute for the mind of an experienced agent. It was mostly experience, Murray knew, the way you fitted evidence together, the way you got a feel for the mind of your target and tried to predict his next move. But more than experience, there was intuition. The two qualities worked together until you couldn't separate them in your own mind. That's the hard part, Murray told himself on the drive home from the embassy. Because intuition can run a little wild if there's not enough evidence to hold on to. You will learn to trust your instincts, Murray told the traffic, quoting from his memorized class notes. Instinct is never a substitute for evidence and procedure, but it can be a very useful tool in adapting one to another. Oh, Dan, you would have made a hell of a Jesuit. He chuckled to himself, oblivious of the stare he was getting from the car on his right. If it's so damn funny, why does it bother you? Murray's instinct was ringing a quiet but persistent bell. Why had Jimmy said that? Obviously it was bothering him, too. But what the hell was it? The problem was it wasn't just one thing. He saw that now. It was several things, and they were interrelated like some kind of three-dimensional crossword puzzle. He didn't know the number of blanks, and he didn't have any of the clues to the words, but he did know roughly the way they fitted together. That was something. Given time, it might even be enough, but... damn! His hands gripped tight on the steering wheel as good humor again gave way to renewed frustration. He could talk it over with Owens tomorrow or the next day, but the bell told him that it was more urgent than that. Why is it so damned urgent? There is no evidence of anything to get excited about. Murray reminded himself that the first case that he'd broken more or less on his own, 10 months after hitting the street as a special agent, had begun with a feeling like this one. In retrospect, the evidence had seemed obvious enough once he'd put the right twist on it, but that twist hadn't occurred to anyone else. And with Murray himself, it had begun as nothing more than the same sort of intellectual headache he was suffering through in his car. Now, he was really mad at himself. Fact. The ULA broke all the rules. Fact. No Irish terrorist organization had ever run an operation in the U.S. There were no more facts. If they ran an op in America... well, they were undoubtedly mad at Ryan, but they hadn't made a move against him over here, and that would have been a hell of a lot easier than staging one in the U.S. What if Miller really was their chief of operations? No, Murray told himself. Terrorists don't usually take things personally. It's unprofessional, and the bastards are professional. They'd have to have a better reason than that. Just because you don't know what the reason is doesn't mean they don't have one, Danny. Murray found himself wondering if his intuition hadn't transformed itself into paranoia with increasing age. What if there's more than one reason to do it? There's a thought, he said to himself. One could be an excuse for the other. But what's the it that they want to do? Motive, all the police procedure manuals said, was the main thing to look for. Murray didn't have a clue on their motive. I could go crazy doing this. Murray turned left off Kensington Road into the upscale neighborhood of flats where he had his official residence. Parking was the usual problem. Even when he'd been assigned to the counter-espionage section of the New York City field office, parking hadn't been this bad. He found a space perhaps 2 feet longer than his car and spent nearly 5 minutes fitting the vehicle into it. Murray hung his coat on the peg beside the door and walked right into the living room. His wife found him dialing the phone, a ferocious scowl on his face. She wondered what was wrong. It took a few seconds for the overseas call to go into the proper office. Bill, this is Dan Murray. We're fine, his wife heard him say. I want you to do something. You know that guy Jack Ryan? Yeah, that's the one. Tell him... Hell, how do I say this? Tell him that maybe he should watch his back. I know that, Bill. I can't say. Something's bothering me, and I can't... Something like that, yeah. I know they've never done it before, Bill, but it's still bothering me. No, nothing specific that I can point to, but Jimmy Owens brought it up, and now he's got me worrying about it. Oh, you got the report already? Good, then you know what I mean. Murray leaned back and stared at the ceiling for a moment. Call it feeling, or instinct. Call it anything you want, it's bothering me. I want somebody to act on it. Good man. How's the family? Oh, yeah? Great. Well, I guess it'll be a happy new year for you. Okay. Take care. Bye. He set the phone down. Well, that feels a little better, he said quietly to himself. The party starts at 9, his wife said. She was used to his bringing work home. He was used to having her remind him of his social obligations. I guess I better get dressed then. Murray rose and kissed his wife. He did feel better now. He'd done something. Probably no more than having people in the bureau wonder what was happening to him over here, but he could live with that. Bill's oldest is engaged. He's going to marry her off to a young agent in the D.C. field office. Anyone we know? New kid. We have to leave soon. Okay, okay. He walked to the master bedroom and started to change for the big embassy party. Chapter 11. Warnings. As you see, ladies and gentlemen, the decision Nelson made in this case had the long-term effect of finally putting an end to the stultifying influence of the Royal Navy's formal tactics. Ryan closed his note folder. There is nothing like a decisive victory to teach people a lesson. Questions. It was Jack's first day back at teaching class. The room had 40 students, all third-classmen. That title included the 6 female mids in the class, or sophomores in civilian terms, taking Ryan's introductory course in naval history. There were no questions. He was surprised. Jack knew he was a pretty good teacher, but not that good. After a moment, one of the students stood up. It was George Winton, a football player from Pittsburgh. "Dr. Ryan," he said stiffly, "I've been asked to make a presentation on behalf of the class." "Uh-oh." Jack took half a step backward and scanned the body of students theatrically for the advancing threat. Mid-3, Winton walked forward and produced a small box from behind his back. There was a typed sheet on the top. The young man stood at attention. "Attention to orders. For service above and beyond the duty of a tourist, even a brainless marine, the class awards Dr. John Ryan the Order of the Purple Target, in the hope that he will duck the next time, lest he become a part of history rather than a teacher of it." Winton opened the box and produced a purple ribbon 3 inches across, on which was inscribed in gold, "Shoot Me." Below it was a brass bullseye of equal size. The mid pinned it to Ryan's shoulder so that the target portion almost covered where he'd been shot. The class stood and applauded as Ryan shook hands with the class spokesman. Jack fingered the decoration and looked up at his class. "Did my wife put you up to this?" They started converging on him. "Way to go, Doc," said an aspiring submarine driver. "Semper Fi," echoed a would-be marine. Ryan held up his hands. He was still getting used to the idea of having his left arm back. The shoulder ached now that he was really using it, but the surgeon at Hopkins had told him that the stiffness would gradually fade away, and the net impairment to his left shoulder would be less than 5%. "Thank you, people, but you still have to take the exam next week." There was general laughter as the kids filed out of the room to their next class. This was Ryan's last for the day. He gathered up his books and notes and trailed out of the room for the walk uphill to his office in Leahy Hall. There was snow on the ground this frigid January day. Jack had to watch for patches of ice on the brick sidewalk. Around him, the campus of the Naval Academy was a beautiful place. The immense quadrangle bordered by the chapel to the south, Bancroft Hall to the east, and classroom buildings on the other sides was a glistening white blanket with pathways shoveled from one place to another. The kids, Ryan thought of them as kids, marched about as they always did, a little too earnest and serious for Jack's liking. They saved their smiles for places where no outsiders might notice. Each of them had his or her shoes spit-shined, and they moved about with straight backs, books tucked under the left arm so as not to interfere with saluting. There was a lot of that here. At the top of the hill, at gate number 3, a Marine Lance Corporal stood with the jimmy-legged civilian guard. A normal day at the office, Jack told himself. It was a good place to work. The mids were easily the equal of the students of any school in the country, always ready with questions, and once you earned their trust, capable of some astonishing horseplay. This was something a visitor to the academy might never suspect, so serious was the kid's public demeanor. Jack got into the steam-heated warmth of Leahy Hall and bounded up the steps to his office, laughing to himself at the absurd award that dangled from his shoulder. He found Robbie sitting opposite his desk.
"What in the hell is that?" the pilot inquired.
Jack explained as he set his books down. Robbie started laughing. "It's nice to see the kids can unwind a little, even in exam season." "So what's new with you?" Jack asked his friend.
"Well, I'm a Tomcat driver again," Robbie announced. 4 hours over the weekend. Oh, man, Jack, I'm telling you, I had that baby talking to me. Took her offshore, had her up to Mach 1.4, did a mid-air refueling, then I came back for some simulated carrier landings, and...
It was good, Jack, the pilot concluded. 2 more months, and I'll be back where I belong.
That long, Rob? Flying this bird is not supposed to be easier. They wouldn't need people of my caliber to do it,
Jackson explained seriously. It must be hard to be so humble. Before Robbie could respond, there came a knock on the open door and a man stuck his head in. Dr. Ryan.
That's right. Join us.
I'm Bill Shaw, FBI.
The visitor came all the way in and held up his ID card. About Robbie's height, he was a slender man in his mid-40s, with eyes so deep-set that they almost gave him the look of a raccoon, the kind of eyes that got that way from 16-hour days. A sharp dresser, he looked like a very serious man.
Dan Murray asked me to come over to see you.
Ryan rose to take his hand.
This is Lieutenant Commander Jackson.
Howdy.
Robbie shook his hand, too.
I hope I'm not interrupting anything.
Not at all. We're both finished teaching for the day. Grab a chair.
What can I do for you?
Shaw looked at Jackson, but didn't say anything.
Well, if you guys have to talk, I can mosey on over to the Oak Club.
Relax, Rob. Mr. Shaw, you're among friends. Can I offer you anything?
No, thank you. The FBI agent pulled the straight-back chair from next to the door. I work in the counterterrorism unit at FBI headquarters. Dan asked me to...
Well, you know that the ULA rescued their man Miller from police custody.
Now Ryan was completely serious.
Yeah.
I caught that on TV.
Any idea where they took him to?
Shaw shook his head. They just disappeared.
Quite an operation, Robbie noted. They escaped to Seaward, right? Some ship picked them up, maybe?
This drew a sharp look.
You notice my uniform, Mr. Shaw? I earn my living out there on the water.
We're not sure, but that is a possibility.
Whose ships were out there? Jackson persisted.
This wasn't a law enforcement problem to Robbie. It was a naval matter. That's being looked at. Jackson and Ryan traded a look. Robbie fished out one of his cigars and lit it.
I got a call last week from Dan. He's a little, I wish to emphasize this, only a little, concerned that the ULA might...
Well, they don't have much of a reason to like you, Dr. Ryan.
Dan said that none of these groups has ever operated over here.
Ryan said cautiously. That's entirely correct, Shaw nodded. It's never happened. I imagine Dan explained why this is true. The provisional IRA continues to get money from over here, I am sorry to say. Not much, but some. They still get some weapons. There is even reason to believe that they have some surface-to-air missiles.
What the hell?
Jackson's head snapped around. There have been several thefts of red-eye missiles. The man-portable one the Army's phasing out now. They were stolen from a couple of National Guard armories. This isn't new. The RUC has captured M-60 machine guns that got over to Ulster the same way. These weapons were either stolen or bought from some supply sergeants who forgot who they were working for. We've convicted several of them in the past year, and the Army's setting up a new system to keep track of things. Only one missile has turned up. The PIRA, tried to shoot down a British Army helicopter a few months back. It never made the papers over here, mainly because they missed, and the Brits were able to hush it up. Anyway, Shaw went on, if they were to conduct actual terrorist operations over here, the money and the weapons would probably dry up quite a bit. The PIRA knows that, and it stands to reason that the ULA does too. Okay, Jack said. They've never operated over here. But Murray asked you to come here and warn me. How come? There isn't any reason. If this had come from anyone except Dan, I wouldn't even be here. But Dan's a very experienced agent, and he's a little bit concerned that maybe you should be made aware of his... It's not even enough to be a suspicion, Dr. Ryan. Call it insurance. Like checking the tires on your car before a long drive.
Then what the hell are you telling me? Ryan said testily.
The ULA has dropped out of sight. That's not saying much, of course. I guess it's the way they dropped out of sight. They pulled a pretty bold operation and... He snapped his fingers. Disappeared back under their rock. Intel, Jack muttered. What's that? Shaw asked. It happened again. The thing in London that I got in the way of. It resulted from very good intelligence information. This did too, didn't it? They were moving Miller secretly, but the bad guys penetrated Brit security, didn't they? I honestly don't know the specifics, but I'd say you probably had that one figured out pretty well, Shaw conceded. Jack picked up a pencil in his left hand and started twirling it. Do we know anything about what we're up against here? They're professionals. That's bad news for the Brits and the RUC, of course, but it's good news for you. How's that? Robbie asked. Their disagreement with Dr. Ryan here is more or less a personal matter. To take action against him would be unprofessional. In other words, the pilot said, when you tell Jack that there's nothing for him to really worry about, you're betting on the professional conduct of terrorists. That's one way to put it, Commander. Another way is to say that we have long experience dealing with this type of person. Uh-huh. Robbie stabbed out his cigar. In mathematics, that's called inductive reasoning. It's a conclusion inferred rather than deduced from specific evidence. In engineering, we call it a wag. Wag? Shaw shook his head. A wild-ass guess. Jackson turned to stare into the FBI man's eyes. Like most operational intelligence reports, you can't tell the good ones from the bad ones until it's too damn late. Excuse me, Mr. Shaw, I'm afraid that we operators aren't always impressed with the stuff we get from the intelligence community. I knew it was a mistake to come here, Shaw observed. Look, Dan told me over the phone that he doesn't have a single piece of evidence to suggest that there is any chance something unusual will happen. I've spent the last couple of days going over what we have on this outfit, and there just isn't any real evidence. He's responding to instinct. When you're a cop, you learn to do that. Robbie nodded at that one. Pilots trust their instinct, too. Now, his were telling him something. So, Jack leaned back. What should I do? The best defense against terrorists, what the security schools teach business executives, for example, is to avoid patterns. Take a slightly different route to work every day. Alter your time of departure somewhat. When you drive in, keep an eye on the mirror. If you see the same vehicle 3 or more days in a row, take the tag number and call me. I'll be glad to have it run through the computer. No big deal. It's probably nothing to be worried about. Just be a little bit more alert. With luck, in a few days or weeks, we'll be able to call you and tell you to forget the whole thing. What I am almost certainly doing is alarming you unnecessarily. But you know the rule about how it's better to be safe than sorry, right? And if you get any information the other way, Jack asked. I'll be on the phone to you 5 minutes later. The Bureau doesn't like the idea of having terrorists operate here. We work damned hard to keep it from happening, and we've been very effective so far. How much of that is luck? Robbie asked. Not as much as you think, Shaw replied. Well, Dr. Ryan, I'm really sorry to have worried you about what is probably nothing at all. Here's my card. If there is anything we can do for you, don't hesitate to call me. Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Jack took the card and watched the man leave. He was silent for a few seconds. Then he flipped open his phone list and dialed 011-441-499-9000. It took a few seconds for the overseas call to get through. American Embassy, the switchboard operator answered after the first ring. Legal attaché, please. Thank you. Wait, please. Jack waited. The operator was back in 15 seconds. No answer. Mr. Murray has gone home for the day. No, excuse me. He's out of town for the remainder of the week. Can I take a message? Jack frowned for a moment. No, thank you. I'll call back next week. Robbie watched his friend hang up. Jack drummed his fingers on the phone and again remembered what Sean Miller's face had looked like. He's 3,000 miles away, Jack, Ryan told himself. Maybe, he breathed aloud. Huh? I never told you about the one I captured, I guess. The one they sprung. The one we saw on TV. Rob, you ever seen... How do I say it? You ever see somebody that you're just automatically afraid of? I think I know what you mean, Robbie said to avoid the question. Jackson didn't know how to answer that. As a pilot, he'd known fear often enough, but always there was training and experience to deal with it. There was no man in the world he'd ever been afraid of. At the trial, I looked at him, and I just knew that he's a terrorist, and he kills people. That would bother me, too. Jackson stood up and looked out the window. Jesus, and they call them professionals. I'm a professional. I have a code of conduct. I train, I practice, I adhere to standards and rules. They're real good at what they do, Jack said quietly. That's what makes them dangerous. And this ULA outfit is unpredictable. That's what Dan Murray told me. Jackson turned away from the window. Let's go see somebody. Who? Just come along, boy. Jackson's voice had the ring of command when he wanted it to. He set his white officer's cap on his head just so. They took the stairs down and walked east, past the chapel and Bancroft Hall's massive prison-like bulk. Ryan liked the academy campus, except for that. He supposed it was necessary for all the mids to experience the corporate identity of military life, but Jack would not have cared to live that way as a college student. The odd mid snapped a salute at Robbie, who returned each with panache as he proceeded in total silence, with Jack trying to keep up. Ryan could almost hear the thoughts whirring through the aviator's head. It took 5 minutes to reach the new Lejeune Annex across from the Halsey Fieldhouse. The large glass and marble edifice contrasted with Bancroft's stolid gray stone. The United States Naval Academy was a government complex, and hence exempt from the normal standards of architectural good taste.
They entered the ground floor past a gaggle of midshipmen in jogging suits, and Robbie led him down a staircase into the basement. Jack had never been here before. They ended up in a dimly lit corridor whose block walls led to a dead end. Ryan imagined he heard the crack of small-bore pistol fire, and it was confirmed when Jackson opened a heavy steel door to the Academy's new pistol range. They saw a lone figure standing in the center lane, a .22 automatic steady in his extended right hand. Sergeant Major Noah Breckenridge was the image of the Marine non-commissioned officer. 6'3", the only fat on his 200-pound frame was in the hot dogs he'd had for lunch in the adjacent Dahlgren Hall. He was wearing a short-sleeved khaki shirt. Ryan had seen but never met him, though Breckenridge's reputation was well known. In 28 years as a Marine, he had been everywhere a Marine can go, done everything a Marine can do. His salad bar of decorations covered 5 even rows, topmost among them the Navy Cross, which he'd won while a sniper in Vietnam, part of First Force Recon. Beneath the ribbons were his marksmanship medals, shooting iron, the least of which was a master rating. Breckenridge was known for his weapons proficiency. Every year he went to the national championships at Camp Perry, Ohio, and in 2 of the past 5 years he had won the President's Cup for his mastery of the .45 Colt Automatic. His shoes were so shiny that one could determine only with difficulty that the underlying leather was actually black. His brass shone like stainless steel, and his hair was cut so close that if any gray were in there, the casual observer could never have seen it. He had begun his career as an ordinary rifleman, been an embassy marine and a sea marine. He had taught marksmanship at the sniper school, been a drill instructor at Paris Island, and an officer instructor at Quantico. When the marine detail at the academy had been augmented, Breckenridge had been the divisional sergeant major at Camp Lejeune, and it was said that when he left Annapolis, he would complete his 30-year tour of duty as sergeant major of the Corps, with an office adjoining that of the commandant. His presence at Annapolis was no accident. As he walked about the campus, Breckenridge was himself an eloquent and unspoken challenge to whichever midshipman might still be undecided on his career goals. Don't even think about being a Marine officer unless you are fit to command a man like this. It was the sort of challenge that few mids could walk away from. The Marine force that backed up the civilian guards was technically under the command of a captain. In fact, as was so often the case with the Corps, the captain had the good sense to let Breckenridge run things. The traditions of the Corps were not passed on by officers, but rather by the professional NCOs, who were the conservators of it all. As Ryan and Jackson watched, the sergeant major took a fresh pistol from a cardboard box and slipped a clip into it. He fired 2 rounds, then checked his target through a spotting scope. Frowning, he pulled a tiny screwdriver from his shirt pocket and made an adjustment to the sights. 2 more rounds. Check. Another adjustment. 2 more shots. The pistol was now perfectly sighted and went back into the manufacturer's box. "How's it going, Gunny?" Robbie asked. "Good afternoon, Commander," Breckenridge said agreeably. His southern Mississippi accent spilled across the naked concrete floor. "And how are you today, sir?" "No complaints. I got somebody I want you to meet. This here's Jack Ryan." They shook hands. Unlike Skip Tyler, Breckenridge was a man who understood and disciplined his strength. "Howdy. You're the guy who was in the papers." Breckenridge examined Ryan like a fresh boot. "That's right. Pleased to meet you, sir. I know the guy who ran you through Quantico." Ryan laughed. "And how is Son of Kong?" "Will is retired now. He runs a sporting goods store down in Roanoke. He remembers you. Says you were pretty sharp for a college boy, and I imagine you remember most of what he taught you." Breckenridge gazed down at Jack with a look of benign satisfaction, as though Ryan's action in London was renewed proof that everything the Marine Corps said and did, everything to which he had dedicated his life, really meant something. He would not have believed otherwise in any case, but incidents like this further enhanced his belief in the image of the Corps. "If the papers got things straight, you did right well, Lieutenant." "Not all that well, Sergeant Major."